Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So Vaisak is the celebration of the life of the Buddha, and this morning Ajahn Kuslo and Ayame Tenandi offered some reflections on the birth and the enlightenment. So these three events, birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana, mark the day for us, the life of the Buddha. We don't usually say the Buddha died, because one of the unfathomables of the Buddhist consciousness is what happens when a body dies, what happens to a Buddhist consciousness. And the Buddha said, if you tried to figure that one out, your head would blow open, so give it up. Just get enlightened and find out. So we say parinibbana, the final nibbana, the final release, the final liberation. And that might seem very distant for us, seem like something which happened so long ago in history. And yet the Buddha, he made this path very accessible, didn't he? And he really grounded it in the lives of ordinary people. One of the things we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is bring forth wholesome states of mind. And a day like this is to bring forth many states of mind, one of course being gratitude. So for me, as a Buddhist monk, my life has been just totally transformed by this. I met my first bhikkhu in India in 1971, who blew me away, as it were. And from his inspiration and from the inspiration of the Buddha, I took up this lifestyle. And so for me, just unspeakable gratitude for this teacher, for the teaching that he offered, and for the lifestyle, because I've been doubly lucky. I've had not only the teaching, but I've also had the lifestyle of a bhikkhu. So you might consider that yourselves now, as you contemplate this day, as you contemplate the life of the Buddha, to bring forth gratitude. And when we talk about sati or mindfulness, one of the types of sati that we talk about is buddhanusati, the recollection of the Buddha. And any time we recollect something which is heroic, something which is beyond the ordinary, something which is profoundly brave and courageous and so on. Any time we really bring that to consciousness, I think that really elevates us, because we see a possibility in this human existence of doing something very grand and very profound and very deep. And so that's one thing we can do today. As you look at a Buddha image, as you look at a stupa, as you contemplate the Dhamma, realize we wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for this extraordinary being so many millennia ago. And to take gratitude as a wholesome state of mind, which you can cultivate, rather than gratitude just coming into play when things work for you. So if someone is nice to you, you're grateful to them. That's just the gratitude of circumstance. But to actually create gratitude or bring forth gratitude all the time is a skill that we do, which is beyond circumstance. It's what we call bhavana, isn't it? We're developing the skillful states of mind. So a Buddha image, as Ajahn Kuslo was saying this morning, a Buddha image points to two things. It points to the teacher, and it points to our possibility of enlightenment. It has both of these qualities. So in terms of gratitude, I don't know about you. I have a shrine, and on my shrine I have two Buddha images, and I have pictures of my teachers, and I have all kinds of interesting things. And when I look at those, they bring forth a sense of gratitude. And this is a very, very helpful, beautiful state of mind, but it's also a foundation for enlightenment. And one of the kind of things I like to joke about is, if when you get enlightened, rather than if, when when you get enlightened, you'll probably be very grateful. Yeah? So why not be grateful now? Why not lay the foundation now for what the enlightened mind is? And the enlightened mind is certainly not greedy. It's not whinging, right? It's not complaining. It's grateful. Now, you can't always be grateful for life's difficulties, but you can cultivate that wholesome quality of gratitude. And so today, I think for me, paramount is this sense of deep gratitude to the Buddha, to his teachings, and to this lineage that we are a part of. To contemplate that which is heroic, I think also, I think for all of us, gives a strong sense of aspiration, that this human birth is very valuable. And particularly our good circumstance that we, as human beings, we live in a culture, in an economy, no matter what they say about the economy, we live in an economy where we have tremendous opportunity for reflection. We're not beset by fear or starvation or kind of disease, and we all get sick, but we do have this incredible human birth living in this culture, in this time. And so how to use that valuably, how to use that skillfully, rather than to fritter it away with trivial pursuits. And so aspiration, so if we think of the life of the Buddha, his renunciation, his enlightenment, and then his giving back for 45 years then. For 45 years after the enlightenment, he taught. He was one of the great walkers of the world. He walked up and down the Ganges Valley, teaching, offering reflection, offering admonishment, dealing with recalcitrant monks, and the whole business of dealing with a lot of people. And so his aspiration was rooted in a very personal question, and his personal question was around death. He said, if I am subject to death, if all those around me are subject to death, is there the deathless? Is there an element or something in consciousness which is not subject to birth and death, birth and death, birth and death? That was his very personal existential problem and question. And he took that, and he took it to enlightenment. He worked, you know, he really worked at his practice. And he took it to enlightenment. But then the enlightenment wasn't simply a personal possession. That would make sense. But the enlightenment then became his expression in life, the way he taught, because he taught from the enlightenment, the way he related to people, his generosity, his giving, his setting up of the Sangha. So his aspiration then, and sometimes people get this wrong, they think that, well, we Buddhists, you Buddhists are so selfish. All you want is enlightenment. As if enlightenment is like some kind of corrupt, self-seeking, narcissistic endeavor. It's not. Enlightenment is the end of ego, among other things. It's the opening of the heart of compassion. It's the opening of the heart of generosity and gratitude. So my first teacher, this monk, he, you know, I think I put that question to him. I can't remember now, but I remember one of the answers he gave me was, it's the selfishness that puts an end to selfishness. It's not self-seeking in a kind of way where I'm ignoring other people, but it's self-investigating. And what the investigation is, it's about my suffering. It's about the conflicts I have, the fears and the arguments I have with life and the whole business. The whole business of being a human being. And that the aspiration to go beyond suffering takes a lot of personal responsibility, doesn't it? It's easy for me to blame or distract, but to actually take that responsibility of aspiration and figure this out. And why this teaching is so, it's so very human, because that's what it addresses. Rather than pitch it to like some kind of high mystical state that you have to achieve, rather he pitches it to the suffering we all have. The fears, the disappointments, the doubts, the aging of the body. He pitches it to all that. And he says, so why do you suffer? Why do you suffer? And you suffer because of attachment. And what is attachment? Attachment is identifying with the movement of life and not realizing that there's a stillness behind the movement, that there's a stillness of awareness, there's a stillness of knowing. So we are moved by fears. We are moved by our prejudices and biases. We're moved by our desires. And the task is then to find that which is unmoving. And that's hidden within awareness. So when we are aware of movement, when we have the courage to watch movement rather than react through movement, we begin to discover this lovely stillness of mind, this beautiful quietness of the mind. Where that quietness takes you is ineffable. You can't really describe it. When your mind gets really, really quiet, you don't describe it. You're just there, aren't you? You're just there with the quietness of the mind. So another thing to ponder on this day is, what is your aspiration? Or how well am I using this human birth? How well am I undertaking this path? Because it's a very rewarding path, but it's very hard work. Ajahn Chah would always say, you know, training your dog is easy, but training your mind is very difficult. It's really difficult because it's such a tricky place, such a tricky set of circumstances. And yet, what could be more interesting and more important and more compelling than to understand what motivates you and why you say what you say and why we do what we do, and to find a place in ourselves where we can make choices for peace. We can create the causes for peace, even if we feel unpeaceful. Now, you'll find this in meditation, let's say. If you're a meditator, and you're just a beginner in meditation, and you sit for 10 minutes, and you start to feel restless, right? And the teacher says, well, hang in there, just another 20 minutes. Yeah, but I want to get up. No, hang in there, just watch the restlessness. What do? You discover that you can make a choice. Still know the restlessness, but you can make a choice for peace. Even though you feel restless. So even though the experience is a bit unpleasant, you've chosen not to attach. You've chosen to witness. You've chosen to be aware of change. And that choice then lays the foundation for the next hour. And you find you get away from the meditation cushion and you feel, well, I feel more peaceful. So even the experience itself maybe wasn't fun, maybe it was difficult, but the choice was towards peace. And that's kamma. That's what we mean by kamma. So in our aspiration, we look at, well, the daily choices I make in my life, what results do they give? We just had a reading on the Wednesday night meeting from Ajahn Chah, and he was saying, people want to be peaceful, but they make the choices of suffering. I want to be peaceful. So let's say I want to be peaceful. I feel annoyed at someone, and I yell at them with wrong language. That's a choice for suffering. So how can I be peaceful if I make choices for suffering? Now we all feel impulses which are towards suffering and conflict, but we can be aware of those. So the lesson you learn in meditation with the restlessness. So I feel restless. I observe that. I do in life all the time. I want to follow some mood or some emotion. I witness to that. In that witnessing, I see it pass, and I make a claim on peace. Peace becomes a part of my consciousness. Why? Because I haven't been a victim. I haven't just followed things. Huh? And this is an ongoing practice we need to do. And I think Vesak and Buddha images and stupas and jetis and all the symbology of the Buddha's enlightenment and the Buddha's life are very helpful that way. You see these pictures on the wall. You have your own shrines. Now, they're not just objects of art. And in Western culture, sometimes people mistake Buddha imagery as garden ornament. So you have a Buddha image and a flamingo. Or, you know, kind of absurd juxtapositions. But what is the Buddha image? It's not that it's sacred in itself, because if we saw this Buddha image was sacred in itself, then we'd be bowing to an idol, or the tanka, or the batik. But that's idolatry, right? But to bow to a Buddha image doesn't mean we're idolatrous. I mean, I don't believe that this beautiful statue, somehow if I bow to it, it's going to, you know, take me to heaven. Obviously not. I'm not dumb. So what is bowing about? Bowing's about bowing, bringing up gratitude, bringing up aspiration, bringing up humility, right? It's not bowing to anything external. It's using the external to motivate the internal. It's using the external to bring forth the wholesome internally. So Buddha images are lovely. They're not necessary. The first Buddha image, I think, was what? Maybe 250 years after the Buddha? Something like that? It took them a long time to come around to that. We're very slow in Buddhism. So before that, there was just an empty Dharma seat or a stupa or the Bodhi tree. There's different kind of symbology around the Buddha image. And then through Indian iconography and in Indian art, the Buddha, first Buddha images came up. So artistically, it doesn't really matter the shape of the Buddha, doesn't it? It has a big nose. It doesn't matter. Or if the robe is a bit off color, it doesn't matter. But if you're just an aesthete and you're artistically hung up, then you have to get your perfect Buddha. And then you're attached. So the Buddha image becomes a form of suffering. You take it the wrong way. But any Buddha image, no matter how gnarled or how weird or whatever, reminds you of the same thing. Freedom, peace, enlightenment. And that it's our possibility. So this is wonderful. These are wonderful things to bring to consciousness. Nowadays, of course, our consciousness is assailed by Armageddon talk. You know, we have one of the four horses of apocalypse is a pig now. Right? Riding through the wilderness. Swine flu is upon us. Economy is going down the tube, right? And we're going to roast to death in 2 years. So it's pretty heavy stuff, right? And these are serious things we have to consider. But if our mind is only preoccupied with that, then of course our mind becomes that. It becomes frightened and negative and, oh, woe is me. Which isn't to say that we don't do something, but having done something, the path of liberation is not dependent on an external, right? The path of liberation is dependent on what I'm doing inside myself. So we do the best we can, but not let the mind get trapped into negativity. This is so easy. It's so easy to find complaint and fault with a lot of things because that's what seems to sell media, seems to make money. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. So to bring forth a wholesome and that takes a special kind of effort. So when, like, say, in the way we use a shrine, you'll notice when Ajahn Kusala and I came in last now, we bow to the shrine. We always bow to the shrine. If we, in our kutis, we try to have a shrine and we bow to the shrine. So we try to use that imagery constantly to awaken to our aspiration. And that is the problem, isn't it? In our religious life, in our spiritual life, is that all of us probably have this aspiration. We're all good people, right? We're otherwise we wouldn't be here, right? But we probably tend to forget. You know, we forget in all kinds of devious ways. Huh? So how do you remember? How do you remember the aspiration? How do you remember, the good work that we do? And one of the ways is Vesak. One of the ways is recollection of the life of the Buddha. One thing I really like to do is I like to read the life of the Buddha. Different accounts or the same account again and again and again. I never get sick of that story. It's just such a great story. That the joke I like to tell, there's a woman living next to one of our monasteries who's a famous actress by the name of whose husband won an Oscar for Dr. Zhivago. Anyway, she's a famous actress. And he was doing a screenplay on the life of the Buddha. Huh? And Ajahn Sumedho asked her, so how's it going? How's the screenplay going? She says, oh, it's a really difficult story. He's a good guy that got better. It's true, you know, that I mean, it's such a wonderful story, archetypal story. So when you've read too much of the Ottawa Citizen and blown your mind away with CNN, take a look at your Buddha, right? Turn on that channel. Turn on the channel of aspiration. Turn on the channel of goodness. One of the things that you find in the text, and Ajahn Chah and many teachers would say, when you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. When you see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. Because there's that famous story where one of the Buddha's relatives was in the robe and was so enthralled by the physical beauty of the Buddha. He was just enthralled, kind of amazed at the physical radiance of the Buddha. And the Buddha says, no, that's not it. It's the Dhamma. So when you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. And that's always here. As we were saying this, as Ajahn Khuslo and Ayame Tenenri were saying this morning, that's always here. The Dhamma is always here. It's not a matter of time, a kaliko. The Dhamma is always here and now. And when you realize the Dhamma, the truth of the way things are, by being awake, by being present, that's Buddha, isn't it? What else could it be? It can't be a cultural form. It can't be gender. It can't be male or female, can it? It can't be that. It can't be thunder. The devas. So the way we honor Vaisakh is by really contemplating the truth of the way things are. And what is the sign that we're not contemplating the truth of the way things are? What is the sign when we don't understand the truth of the way things are? Suffering. That's the sign, isn't it? Because if I understand the truth of the way things are, I'm not going to suffer. Right? But as soon as I make a mistake in attachment, in interpretation, viewpoint, morality, whatever, lifestyle, I'm going to get the results. And if I make the causes for suffering, I'll get suffering. That's the deal. And then I wake up. Then I wake up. Oh, this really hurts. This hurts. I want to get out of this. Right? I want to figure out how to get out of this. And that's the first step of peace. That's the first step of enlightenment. So when life is conflicted or contracted or suffering or whatever, our task is to awaken the mind. This is suffering. Suffering feels this way. And that's another way we look at Buddha, don't we? The awakened mind. You awaken to that. Not judge it. And quite often we're very, very good people, so we're very judgmental. So we have some negative emotion towards someone in the family or someone in our lives, and we think, I shouldn't feel that way. That's not awakening to truth. That's just perpetuating ego. But awakening to truth is this is the way it feels. It feels this way now. And that's a constant refrain you find in Buddhism. And then why am I suffering? Well, because you did that to me. And because the world doesn't, because it's raining. Or because the roof leaks. Or I didn't get the pecan pie. Or it's always out there, isn't it? And of course, if it's out there's no liberation. But if it's in here, what's the cause of suffering? What do I want that I don't have? And what do I have that I don't want? What do I have that I don't want? Huh? What is it? And if I look at that, and I look at the wanting, I say, yeah, I may want it different, but this is the way it is now. And that is release. That's non-attachment. Acceptance. Socially, we do our best. So, build monasteries and invite great teachers to come and so on and so forth. But inwardly, there is this continual work to do. And because it is hard work, you need to really encourage yourself. If you put yourself down and say, oh, I got angry again, or oh, I didn't meditate enough, Bhante's going to ask me, how's my meditation going? And, then you get depressed. So you need to work hard in this path, but you need to encourage yourself. Always kind of try to bring in the wholesome and the uplifting. Because it is hard work. It's very hard work. But it's the most rewarding work. And it's the work that is the best thing for our society. Because whatever responsibilities that we have with our parents, in the computer labs, in the marketplace, at the university, wherever we are, if we're coming from that enlightened mind, from the mind of clarity, isn't that the best thing we can give our workmates? Or our family? Or our friends? Or whoever? Isn't that the most wonderful gift you could give a person, is your own enlightenment? You've if you meet a great teacher like Ajahn Chah or Lompo Sumedho, and you're touched by them, you are touched by these people, you think, oh, thank you. They're so grateful to be in their presence. Huh? So isn't, and what do? Well, they just watch their breath. Don't make a problem, right? You go to them and you say, no. I say, what? Don't make it a problem. Let go. No big teaching, but hard to do. Very hard to do.